Still Alive, a look at people making things. The Luthier. Peter Brooks meets Gina Lefaux.
Hello, Peter. Come on in.
Ah, Gina, thanks.
My name is Gina Lefaux. I'm a musician. I'm a luthier. I make and restore violins and other stringed instruments.
Gina has invited me to join her in her workshop. It's a long, narrow building with a sound-treated room at one end for recording use. Going through that leads into the main workshop, which is dominated by a large wooden workbench along one side and underneath the window to get most light. On the bench is a glue pot, and in racks on the walls a selection of chisels, saws, planes and other tools. On the other side of the room are shelves full of sheets and blocks of wood, lots of violins in various states of repair, and leaning against the wall, a dismembered cello.
Yeah, I've got a cello in for restoration. I've just put this padding on the bench first of all. Yeah, just to protect the back of the cello, really. So we've got it, as you say, it's in kit form. So what we've got here is a cello that's made up of various parts. I mean, it's an old instrument. Just get the other bits. The belly and the neck over here. Okay, so what we've got is, it's an unlabeled instrument. It's inside, it's covered in tool marks. You can see all the marks where the toothed planes have been used to plane the inside to get the shape. This is what we call a provincial instrument. I hate the word provincial, but in terms of art and that, that's a term that is used. And it means basically somebody, a local made thing in a small place that maybe isn't a influential, shall we say. So they were always as well, or they tended to be a couple of steps behind the trends. So sometimes you get making that hints at being a lot older, and it's merely the fact that they were making for maybe the local church or the local country dance band or something. So they just made what was necessary for that, rather than the super duper advances of the modern age.
It's quite hard for me to see what the problems really are. The front or belly has been detached, and the back has the ribs or sides of the cello still in place.
So this cello, it's got a few cracks in the back here, and the ribs and the back. Now, there's a difference in quality, and there's also a difference in the colour of the varnish. Now, the ribs would normally be maple or sycamore, and I think these are just about discernible as being, I think, plain maple. Now, they're not the original ribs. They are much too modern, because the way that they are set in, and with these corner blocks and the linings, that's a more modern way of doing things. The back, I would say, is probably mid to late 18th century. So it's what we call a composite instrument. It means it's more than one part. Now the belly on this, which is the front of the instrument here. Now the F holes look a lot older than the instrument, but they're not. Again, I think it's the provincial thing where they're not keeping up to date with the times. For me, I would say that the front and the back, they may be originally the same instrument, but I have a feeling that the front is somewhere around the 1820s or something like that. And the ribs, I would say they could be the 1920s. So
It's a bit of a bitzer, really.
I think it's going to sound great. My client is actually, they bought this in an auction in UK, and they're out in Germany, my client, and they had it delivered here. We had a, you know, I had a look at photographs and stuff first of all. Then they sent it up to me, and I've been having a good look, and I'm now ready to start on the restoration.
I'm interested to see exactly what Gina is going to do to get the cello in good order.
Yeah, the inside of this cello has to have a few corrections done to it, otherwise the ribs and the block, top and bottom blocks and that will be, they won't fit correctly. So I'm just correcting a bit of work that the original maker overlooked. It's fine. And a bit of scraping just to tidy that up. So that's better. It means the blocks will sit flat now when I re-glue them in place. Very much signs of haste in the construction of the cello.
So you're sorting out what somebody did badly then?
Well, not badly, I just see it as a different take on reality. We have a very different way of looking at things these days. We look for perfection, maybe, and maybe we don't know what perfection is, I don't know. I see some of these old instruments, some of the more kind of provincial instruments, and I see them as a real masterpiece of people with limited knowledge and skills. And I see that as being, you know, it's like look at a painting and you go, wow. That might not be the best skillful artist, but what if they captured something special? I like the individuality of metal violin making. I like the quirkiness of it all. It can be, as you can see, a bit of a problem getting it into a situation where it'll last another 200 years. But, you know, I wouldn't be unhappy to be in that condition when I'm 200. I don't know about you.
It's quite tiring standing up at the bench, so we're going to leave the cello for a while and go and have a chat about how Gina got into this line of work over a cup of tea.
Well, when I was in my late teens, you know, I was really... My uncle played the fiddle. He gave me his fiddle and I was a mandolin player. Played the guitar first, then went to the mandolin. And the fiddle just... It was like something special, you know. It was like the first car, only someone had invented the brakes as well. It was complete, and I just was fascinated by it all, and I always thought, I want to learn to make. And I was on holiday, I think it was about 18, and I found a book. I was in the Isle of Man, I found a book on the violin, and it was a really kind of heavy book, but I managed to get all the way through it. And it's fascinating reading about Stradivari, the Amati family, and the Guarneris and people. I was hooked then, that was it. I couldn't get enough, couldn't sort of go past a fiddle shop without hanging around outside looking in the windows and stuff. I got really passionate about violins, researching them and stuff. And it was when I came out in my life, there was some difficulties, and initially I lost work, and then I kind of disappeared off the scene for quite some time, and I immersed myself into violin making. Worked for one of the main dealers in the Midlands. I was an outworker, and I used to do a couple of days a week in the shop, and I learnt loads about violins, and it affected my whole approach to violin making, seeing older instruments, and that's my forte really. The 18th century instruments, particularly from the British Isles, and and Ireland. And then I met with a guy called Chris Ray, who was from Eastbourne. He was originally a cabinet maker, very fine craftsman, and he used to build lutes. And I started to hang out with Chris, and I learnt loads. He was the first repair I ever did. He made me do it. He kind of forced me into it because I was very unconfident. You know, it's like most people say, you know, I wouldn't know what to do. Well, I didn't. So I happened to be in a situation where somebody knew more than I and shared it with me. And then eventually, Chris had it in Sheffield, actually. He had a workshop in Garden Street, which I think it may have, I think the buildings might still be there. It was old cutlery area, and there was some artists and that. And I used to go and hang out at Chris' workshop, and I learnt loads of stuff. He made me some tools, and we worked on some projects together. And yeah, in fact, in my workshop as we are now, there are tools in this very room, and there is wood and stuff which belonged to Chris, because sadly he died as a young man, really. And I was given, I was given some stuff from his workshop, and I still have his unfinished violin, which I thought, should I finish it? And I don't know, really. It's one of those things, isn't it? I'd like to be... He was such a good craftsman. You know, you never feel good enough to work on something like that. But yeah, Chris was a big, important part of it for me.
There's something very pleasing to me to think that as well as the knowledge being passed on, the old tools find a new home too.
I think it's really important, yeah. I have I have tools going back to well into the 19th century, violin tools, which I've picked up from various places, you know. I had no personal connection with the old shop in Liverpool, Rushworth and Drapers, who were in the early 20th century. They were quite a big-time violin dealers. But I had sort of connections with people that had worked there, and I managed to buy a job lot of stuff out of a woman whose dad had worked in Rushworth years ago, and when he died they cleared his house, and I've got some tools that are now used in Rushworth and Drapers because they're stamped by the people who work there, and I think that's most important to me. I still have those tools, I look after them because they are a footprint in the sand, really, and if we didn't record these things and keep them, the tide would just wash over and that would be it, lost forever. And I think art should be respected, and those who create it too, and not just their work.
The cello won't restore itself, so it's back into the workshop for the next stage.
Now the back of the cello and the front, between them, when the front's on, there's a thing called the soundpost, and it's like a dowel of pine, and it stands up and it touches the back and the belly. So it doesn't jam in between, it fits there, and the pressure of the strings on the bridge and that hold it in place. Now, because it's a pole basically connecting the front and the back, if you have a bit of an impact, there's a possibility that it could crack the back or the belly. Now, you often get soundpost cracks in the belly, the front, because it's softer wood. And they're repairable, fine. The back is the more difficult one. It's hardwood and it's, you know, it's a bit of a nuisance. Now, this has got this cello's actually got a soundpost crack in the back. Now, to work on it, you've got to inlay a patch of wood. Now, to make sure that you don't distort the shape of the back, you need to cast a large area of the back in plaster and then secure the cello so that when you're working you don't get any movement, and then when you've got your patch you glue it in place, and only after it's dried and you've planed it down to the right thickness do you sort of take it out of the plaster cast. So what I'm going to do now is the cast is there and the cello's in, I'm going to start working. First of all, I'm going to take some wood out of this with a scraper. So I'm going to work on the area where the crack is. So So what I'm doing is I'm kind of taking, I'm sort of evening out the bumpy surface here, because if I'm going to put a patch in, I need to get this so that it's capable of taking a patch evenly. Yeah, as this area is under so much stress, really, or can be, as I say, if it takes an impact, you really need to make sure that the crack doesn't open up again. So what you're doing is you're spreading by putting a patch inside. You're spreading that into a broader area, that pressure. And the next stage will be, I'm going to get the patch, finalise the outline. I've just evened this up so I can do it. We'll put the patch in and I'll go around it. And then what I'll do is I will get the gouge out. I'll get a gouge and I'll start to remove a very thin layer of wood. And then I'll tidy the edge up. And then the wooden patch will be glued and cramped in position, and it'll have a very fine scarf edge to it. So it'll just blend in with the original work. So that's what we're doing, just a little bit more scraping before we get... Yeah, these are cabinet scrapers made of steel. In the old days, someone said to me, use a saw blade, an old saw blade. It took me about 18 months to saw it out. I could have escaped from Alcatraz quicker, I'll tell you. It was so damned hard. So what I do now is I buy some fine, good quality ones and then shape them in accordance to what I need, because you need to have a lot of different shapes. Cabinet ones are good for large, flatter areas and that, but we have some curves and stuff, so you end up making your scrapers to suit. Okay, what I'm going to do now is I've marked out where the patch is going in the back, and I've taken some of the uneven wood away with the scraper. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to use a thumb plane. A thumb plane is basically a plane about as big as your thumb, I guess, as a clue in the name. This one is brass. It's about 100 and a bit years old. It's got a blade going in like a normal plane, but the sole, the base of the plane, is curved. It's ever so slightly curved end to end, and it's curved across. So if you were to use this, it would cut out a similar shape to a curved gouge. It wouldn't be a flat cut. So what you can do with this is you can take wood out in parallel cuts, and then you can go slightly across them so that you're actually lowering the wood down. It's a good way of removing wood under control. Sometimes with a gouge, it's awkward to get in places and get a flow, but with this, you can get good control over it. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to start taking some wood out of the back so I can get the fit the patch. It's a real pain when you have to go across figured wood, and when I say figured, I mean the pattern that you get in the aces and in maple and sycamore. So what we use is what we call the toothed blade. When you look at the blade of a plane, it's usually flat with the sharp edge. Now, a toothed blade is a blade which has grooves cut in it. So when you sharpen it up, it's almost like it's a series of blades side by side with a gap in between. So it's, you know, it's an indented thing. And what it does is it cuts without splitting wood. Those separate little blades, or what they give the impression of being, actually cut through figure without tearing it. So you can work your way through some quite hard and knotty wood, really. And you can do it without ripping the wood. You need to use tools that give you control. That's your selection, really. That's what you're choosing. You're choosing something that will do the job, but something that will allow you to do the job, not just, oh, that's the right shape. You know, you're using technique as well as the tool. And part of the technique is your selection of the tools you use. Yeah, it's not a big heavy-handed job, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to do it neatly and delicately. with restoration, when you come to doing some of the carving, you've got a finite thing that's already there and you're trying to make what you're adding to it or make your repair fit it. Whereas when you're making, you've the freedom to do what you like, so you will use the tools differently. Yeah, one of the important things as well when you're doing stuff like this where you're actually fitting a patch is you need to determine with accurate calipers the thickness of the wood to start with so that you can make sure that you're not going to go right through. It's not like as if you're going to go through and leave a tiny little veneer with the varnish and then you're going to put a new piece of wood in. You're not doing that. You're actually putting a patch that's wide enough to distribute the stress caused by the soundpost, and you're trying to blend it into the original work, because it's not like you do a neat patch and go, there you go, you can see that from space, but it's great. You're trying to do it so it doesn't distract from what's there originally. You're trying to fit your work into it. So you're also looking at having a good collection of wood, different periods, you know, different age wood, different types of wood and that would be used for violin making, different figures. Different figures or patterns in wood. And, you know, what you do in restoration is you never throw anything away. I don't. I've got boxes of offcuts of wood, tiny bits, almost dust, really. But they're all very, very useful because some of it's, you know, period wood from 18th century or whatever. Bits of scrap from, you know, from, I guess, breakers. I prepared the area for the soundpost patch and I have now fitted the patch and glued it in place and cramped it up. So the cello's now in the corner of the workshop out of the way and it'll be dry in 24 hours or so. Then I'll check it. Then I can work on the final thicknessing of the wood, etc. And then I can get on with doing some of the other bits.
Now that the cello is glued and drying, I'm interested to find out how Gina learned to recognise what gives away the provenance of an instrument.
It's always handy in life to watch somebody else make mistakes because you learn so much from it, and sometimes you learn from how they respond to what they've done too, you know. And I had the good fortune of, when I was working for a shop in the Midlands, I was also playing traditional music with the guy who set the business up. And we were on the road, we went to auction houses all over the country, we visited dealers, we visited everywhere. We'd get the local paper when we were doing a gig in an area. We'd sit in the van going through all the free papers and finding things. And I would be his accomplice. And we'd go around to places and, you know, he'd look at a violin and say, oh, that's German, or this is French, or whatever, and he'd come up with a price and buy it or wouldn't. We recognise characteristics. Violins, musical instruments, are no different, really. You've got the characteristics of the style of making. You've also got techniques, which mean that you can look and work out how it's made, and if a certain technique was used that a particular school of making didn't use, then it won't be from there. And with older stuff, you've got, you know, the historic side of it, like violins were not exactly the way they are today. There's a lot of major changes gone on. And so you can date instruments by what the changes are, what's been done to it, and what hasn't, in terms of authenticating if something is the real deal or not. But it's just like learning the characteristics and then the finer points, like French violins, German violins and English violins. My passion really is English, Irish and Scottish violins. I just think that they are wonderful pieces of individual expression.
There's just one violin and a bow hanging on the wall, so it looks ready to play rather than sitting waiting to be repaired.
This is a violin I made in about 1995. It's one I've been playing a lot. I've used it for a lot of recording sessions. It's been all over the shop. It's been around America with me and stuff like that. Means a lot to me, this. I mentioned my friend Chris Ray, who was an inspiration on my making initially. But when Chris died, I was given some tools and some wood and things from his workshop. And one of the pieces was a piece of spruce. And what I did was I made a violin, and I made the belly from a piece of wood I got from Chris's workshop. And the back was made from a piece of wood that was given me by a man who I learned some of my techniques and skills from, a man called Ken Grimley, who was a violin maker and cellist. And he gave me some wood, and I've made the back out of a piece from Ken. And the ribs and the neck I made from the first piece of violin wood, maple, that I ever bought. And it's my fiddle. It incorporates a lot of things within it. And it's red, and I'm a Scouser, so that's very good, isn't it, really? Yeah, I mentioned also I learned my music around Merseyside. I learned to play traditional music, and that's where I teach. I was the last pupil of James Carmichael, who was a great Ulster Scots fiddle player from Ballymena. I learned a lot from him when I was young, when he was living in the Merseyside area. And learned lots about bow control and stuff. So I'm going to play a piece of music on my fiddle. This is a tune. It's called the Liverpool Hornpipe.
The luthier is Gina Lefeu. The Still Alive theme music was composed and played by Frank Birtwistle. The making of Still Alive was supported by the Audio Content Fund. Still Alive is presented and produced by Peter Brooks for UpperHearst.com.